Welcome to Awaken Empowered TV. I'm your host, Ethan Fox. I have a really incredible show planned for you today with Simon Parks, who is a lifelong experiencer of extraterrestrial races and also has held a public office in the UK. A lot of you know who he is, and if you don't, I'll let him tell you his personal story in his own words. So without any further delay, here's Simon Parks. Hello, Simon. Welcome to Awaken Empower TV. It's a pleasure to be finally speaking with you. I've heard so much about you from a lot of my contacts, and so I had to finally get you on my show and speak to you myself. So thank you for taking the time. I know you're a very busy guy.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me. It's very kind of you. You're doing a lot of great work. So it was a great privilege for me to be invited, and of course I said yes.
Thank you. Well, first, I'd really like to get a foundation for who you know, the life that you had more in the conventional sense. Like, what was your childhood like? And I know you had a political career for a little while. I'd really, and even your education, if you had any formal education, which I imagine you must have had if you ended up in politics. Can you paint kind of a picture of what your life was like early on in that sense?
Yes, I'll give it a go. I had a mum and a dad, but my father left the family home when I was quite young, and mother decided that she didn't want to remarry, nor did she have any boyfriends. So she brought me up herself, which was quite an ordeal. I think back in the 1960s, that must have been quite something. But she had a very wealthy father, although they were estranged. He did support her and help her, and that I think was a great comfort to her in many ways. My grandfather paid for me to what we call in England to go to a public school, which may mean something differently to you guys. It's a private school. And then from that, I went to a state school and decided to go into the army. So after leaving school, I went and joined the British Army, because I really didn't know what I wanted to do. And then having left and done time there, I then went and worked as a manager in a jewelry shop. So that was something different, but it was very conventional. I ended up being a manager in one of the biggest jewelry shops in Britain, in the centre of London, in Oxford Street. So my life in terms of what we'd call the conventional life has ticked along, married, have children, had my own business, and currently I'm a director of a renewable energy company. So in many ways, of course, it's a success story, but it's something that flies in the face of some of the elements that I've brought to the world in terms of my experiences. And of course, as a politician, I've been elected to three times now and served three terms of office in different places. And of course, that again, it's something that if fully conversant with the system and you're not accepted by the system. So that's my conventional lifetime. And of course, it's a good counterbalance to the story that I give.
And a few cats also, I heard, right?
Huh. Well, I'm over 50 years old now. And if I look back on my life, maybe only 5 of those years have I been without a cat. And always had a cat, and I have lots of cats, and anyone who's seen any of my videos will see the cats. And when I Skype my clients, there's always a cat around, and yes, they steal the show.
So tell me a little about how did that segue into politics? Did you get an education in law, or how did you end up in politics?
No, it's a very interesting in Britain. You can go through politics through just passion and belief. You don't have to have come through a set school or a set college. You have to be a very good speaker. You have to win people's votes. I joined a major political party, and the political party has to decide whether you are worthy of standing for office. So if the party doesn't back you, just as it would be with the Republicans and the Democrats, if the membership of that party don't want you, then you don't go forward. And I threw my hat into the ring and was accepted. And I was elected twice in London in what we would call a city councillor in London. And then I left with my wife and we moved to another part of Britain. And I said, well, I've worn the T-shirt now. I've done it all. I don't really want to do it again. But the political party was always on at me, you know, get back involved. Please fight for your local community. And in the end, I decided and I stood again and I was elected. Although, interestingly enough, on this election, which was in February 2012, I think, this was after I'd gone public with my stories. And I think what caught the media's attention was that the public voted for me, even though the media had done its level best to try to make me look, not a competent person. But the electors who'd come to my stump meetings, who'd come to the community halls to hear me speak, had met me in the Mall, etc. They made that decision. And so it rather shocked people when I was elected. And that was very useful because it showed that the people in the big story blocks, the big tower blocks, don't always know what's going on the ground. So the people on the ground liked me and voted for me. And for some people, that was a real problem.
So you went public with your extraterrestrial connections prior to that, winning that second election?
Yeah, 2011. And then my election was in 2012.
And why do you think that people accepted that, because it seems like, especially, well, we're in the United States here, and so although there is a growing community of people who seem to accept and be very much progressive in that sense, it seems like the mainstream here is still very much of a more conventional mindset and would find that a bit odd and would probably shy away from that. And certainly the media would, you know, at this point, appear to turn the mainstream against a politician with credentials like that. So why do you think you were successful?
That's a really good question. And a number of mainstream media commentators have asked me that, genuinely asked me it, because they couldn't work it out themselves. Basically, I think the people who bothered to turn up to my meetings and hear what I had to say, for them, they were able to counterbalance what the media was saying with meeting me, the real man, the real politician. And they came away from it saying, well, we prefer to believe what we've seen with our own eyes and not what we've seen on the television or the read in the newspapers. And I got around my area. I had a lot of meetings. I literally just called on hundreds of doors, just knocked on the doors, introduced myself. And ultimately, when it came to the day of the election, people were prepared to vote for somebody they'd met rather than they'd read an article about him in the newspaper. And many times I know the media went back to my area and interviewed people who'd voted for me and asked why they'd voted for me. And they actually said, because he's a good man and he will get things done for me. So the fact that there was this alien type story, it didn't seem to bother them at all. What they wanted was a politician who would fight their corner, get the streetlights working, get the buses running, get the refuse truck around. That's what they wanted. And they saw that in me. And regardless of what else I said, because ultimately I hadn't broken any law. There was no law that had been broken. And in Britain, we'd gone through a phase where a number of politicians had been arrested and put in prison, found guilty of defrauding, stealing the public purse. So, you know, on one hand, you've got politicians who are in prison for defrauding people, stealing money. And then there's this guy who sees things in the sky. So, of course, they had no problem because they were able to compare somebody who they'd met and who they liked and somebody who they were reading a story about but couldn't connect it. So the problem wasn't with the people on the ground. The problem was the people higher up who failed to grasp the whole situation and frankly were outmaneuvered, because they were outmaneuvered by a situation that changed every minute. And they were working into a plan which they thought would just run in a certain way and didn't.
Now, do you think this is a phenomenon that's local to the UK, or is this something that you're observing globally, that people are on a more mass scale starting to open their mind to people in power such as yourself, as opposed to more of the mainstream mindset?
I think it's because the gap or the gulf between the people and the lawmakers has grown so big that the people now no longer believe what they're being told. So when somebody comes along and is different, it's almost as if it's a refreshing change. And the vast majority of the public will say that person isn't a stereotypical guy out of the same mold. He's different and it's refreshing and we like it. Whereas the same sort of person, the same sort of argument is wheeled out time and time again. And frankly, the vast majority of people are only voting out of desperation now. They don't actually passionately believe in change. Many of them don't believe anything really will happen for the good. They're just voting because this is their last hold on democracy. So I think in my case, it was just simple. Here's a guy who's bothered to get around the doorstep. He's gone round to the local papers. He's been interviewed on radio. He's not frightened of the subject. We like him. That was the bottom line. They liked me. That's why they voted for me. If they didn't like me, I wouldn't have been elected.
Mm-hmm. So let's back up and talk a bit about your childhood and the alien story that you just mentioned a second ago. Now, you mentioned your grandfather was a member of the Illuminati. Am I correct?
Yes.
Okay. And so can you paint a little bit of a picture of what that childhood was like and clear that up for me? Because I'm not exactly sure I understand that.
Okay. Well, it is interesting for American viewers and listeners because although this is what appears to be a very British or English story, it isn't. My mother worked for British intelligence, and the domestic arm of British intelligence is called MI5. But she was told that she was actually working for the National Security Agency of America. But she was working for MI5 because she was a British subject. So she had to be managed by British intelligence. But everything that she was doing was being shared equally between British intelligence and the NSA. And my grandfather worked for the foreign arm of British intelligence, which is locally called MI6. But he was told he was working for the CIA. So I have my mother and my grandfather, who are very much involved with the British side of intelligence, but ultimately reporting back to an American organization or agency. So I think that has some great resonance with American or North American listeners or viewers, because there shows this very close connection between Great Britain and the United States. So when I grew up in not a military family or a political family, but I grew up in an espionage family. My grandfather wasn't like James Bond 007. He didn't run around from country to country with a gun and a silencer. He was an armchair intelligence agent. He would sit in an armchair and he would make decisions, and then he would fly and meet statesmen, presidents, prime ministers. He met JFK in 1962. So he would meet with these people, and he met Joseph Stalin 3 years before Stalin died. So he would meet with these people and he would put the British government's view in a way that only a diplomat can. My grandfather disliked politicians. So his role was to try to gain understanding between countries that were not politically biased. In other words, if you have a change in government, whatever decision you've made can be changed. But if you make a decision or an agreement which is made between countries, no matter what politicians come and go, the decision stays the same. So that was his role. So I grew up in an environment where world politics was always discussed, domestic politics, and of course, we haven't discussed the alien element, but that was very much part of it. So my grandfather was a very strong guiding factor, and often my mother and grandfather, her dad, would fall out over how I was to be brought up.
And are they still involved in the intelligence agencies?
My mother died in 1979, and my grandfather died in about 1992. So no, they're no longer with us.
So you no longer have connections or I'm curious, I've listened to a number of your interviews and you seem to have answers for virtually everything. So I'm curious, where.
Oh, that's very kind of you to say.
So I'm curious, I guess the direction I'm going with that question is, where does a lot of your knowledge and information come from? Is it intuitive? Is it channeled? Is it connections you have with various agencies due to your governmental and family background? Or where does it primarily come from?
Okay. Not channeled. Channeling is very dangerous, in my opinion. Not always. Can be hacked, and people can receive automatic writing or voices in their head from somewhere. It's not always where they think it's coming from. I still have very strong connections with organizations whose role is to protect this country and your country. But I also have what I refer to as off-world connections. When I'm interested and I make a statement, so when I have two independent sources backing up my information. So if somebody from a three-letter agency was to say to me, this is a situation occurring here, and then an off-world connection says the same thing in its own way, I will then go public because I have two separate forms of information. So that's basically it. So no, I don't work for any secret intelligence service, but I certainly have connections with them.
So you said an agency that is tasked with, I forget exactly your terminology, but essentially protecting the people of the world. I don't suppose you can, is that a public agency or is this some private secret agency you're talking about?
Well, I thought the NSA was a private secret agency. I must be confused. The NSA is an agency that's so much at arm's length that it operates on its own. The CIA is more controlled by the executive, but both organizations are tasked with sort of things that I would perhaps talk about or be involved in.
So this is where you're getting some of that information that you're verifying with off-world sources then?
Well, I said to you three-letter agencies. I'm not going to specify a particular agency. You wouldn't expect me to, but basically there are organizations, and it's very interesting. You said tasked with protecting the world, and I think that's very, very interesting. I wouldn't say it's a Freudian slip, but certainly America does take on the mantle as the protector of the world, although ultimately if you boil it down, it is there to protect American citizens. So yes is the answer. These are the organizations that have the access to the most information, and nearly every country responds to them. So yes, these are the people who would want to talk to me, for heaven's sake. Why wouldn't they? It makes sense. If you're an agency and they're wonderful, just to have knowledge, excuse me, seems to have knowledge that you don't think is public, then you would want to know how they know. You would research that person, and if you would believe that they were bona fide, you would then wish to open a conversation with them. And that's happened in all cases, including the Vatican. So even the Vatican likes to have a chat with me.
I see. So these are just some examples of the caliber of agencies you're working with, or that you're getting some of your information. And then am I on the right track so far?
Yes.
Okay. And then you're confirming that with off-world sources. So when you say off-world sources, you say you're not channeling them. So what is the medium of communication that you use to communicate with these off-world sources? Are you physically meeting with them, or is it telepathic, or how do you facilitate that?
Yeah. Well, they don't ring me on my cell phone. So it's something that's happened ever since I've been very little. These beings or entities, however else you want to categorize them, will actually make an appearance. It's maybe early days in the interview yet, but there is a distinction between what the media would call extraterrestrial, which is ET, which is everyone knows what that means. But people don't really understand it, because to them, every alien creature is an ET. But technically, that's not accurate. If an alien creature goes in a spacecraft and takes 20, 30, 40 years to get here, they are extraterrestrial. But if they have another form of technology which allows them to get here very quickly, within seconds, then there is another terminology, and that is an extra-dimensional entity. That is a creature that can appear in your front room just like that. very hard to detect, very hard for any American or British military to act, react quickly enough. They will go in, spend 2 or 3 minutes, and get out as quickly as they arrived. But that is enough time for a two-way communication to take place. Now, as a child, I was, in the early days, very frightened. Of course, I would be terrified by that. But I said to one news guy once, if you took a six-month-old baby and then put it on an airplane in JFK Airport and then flew it to Dallas, and every week you put that baby on a flight, by the time that child was 5 years old, it would be so confident, providing nothing bad happened, that it would fly around the world. And so because my experiences occurred when I was very young and nothing bad happened to me, I was then confident and capable of holding conversations. Most people freak out, and I fully understand that. But in my case, I didn't. And so it's been very useful because I've been able to obtain information, which has been beneficial.
So basically various extra dimensional beings appear in your environment and you carry on conversations with them.
Correct.
Okay. So let's back up to your childhood again. I want to know a little bit about your mother and your father. And I might be misunderstanding, but from what I understand, there's some alien or extraterrestrial or extra dimensional connection there with your family.
Yes. It usually goes through the bloodline. It's not my research, but many researchers have found that the Rh negative bloodline seems to occur time and time again, with people who claim, you know, alien contacts. So that was something that came up very clearly. My father was born in what is called Iran, but at the time was called Persia, and he was, Jewish, and, he was able to claim a direct lineage back to the kings of Persia and from that back to Sumeria. So he had a very, very interesting line through the Mesopotamia triangle area, whereas my mother was very British and, you know, very what we would call a sort of a Germanic-type Briton. She had blue eyes and blonde hair. So that was, I think, what we would call the bloodline link. In terms of experiences, my mother, as I was growing up, was the only person who would totally take down what I said seriously and would often ask me to draw what I'd seen. And then she said she would take the drawings to what she called her friends, who would then look at them. So my mother encouraged me to always draw down what I'd seen, and then she would take them away. So she was very supportive. But then the conversations that I was privy to, she had to be supportive because she was holding conversations with people regarding a whole range of subjects, which at that time, back in the late 60s and early 70s, vast majority of the public wouldn't have a clue about. I mean, you know, for a young boy, I would have been, 10 years old, to hear conversations about the situation at Roswell back in 1947. I mean, that was unheard of in Britain. I mean, probably only a handful of people in Great Britain who knew about the spacecraft crash in Roswell. Yet here in my apartment, in my front room, this was a topic that often came up.
So, I want to go on a tangent there since you brought it up. So what exactly do you know that happened in Roswell that we don't know in the conventional news reports or that we've been told?
Well, I think the good thing is that many people have looked on the alternative media and the internet and have made their own views. But what was interesting was that my mother had mentioned that Einstein and von Braun, Einstein, of course, the great scientist, and von Braun, the developer and designer of the V2 rocket, were both taken. Now, what was interesting was that a guy called Colonel Corso wrote a book called, I think, something like The Day After Tomorrow or something like that. Well, I actually managed to get in contact with his son, Corso Jr. And I said to him, you know, I can confirm from my own mother's lips that von Braun and Einstein were taken. He said, yes, his father, Colonel Corso, had said that. And so that was great because it verified, you know, both what my mother was saying, because there was the son other guy who had had that first-hand experience. So it was quite good because it strengthened him as well, because here was someone in Britain who we'd never heard of actually saying, yeah, it's quite common knowledge in the secret services that, you know, you took your Germans with you, and they held it out. So Roswell was a situation that was very orchestrated, very controlled. And I don't blame the American system at all. I don't blame them for the way they handled it. It was a almost unique situation. The only thing that I would say that also the alternative media don't seem to have got a handle on is there were a very large number of military men who were shot, because these were military guys who saw things that their pay grade didn't cover them for. They couldn't go shooting the civilians. They either paid the civilians off or threatened them. But when you're in the military, they can do it. And a number of military guys were shot because they had seen things and refused to keep quiet. So that's something that's quite shocking. And I can understand why that wouldn't want to come out. But most of the things that we know in the alternative media, I think, are about right. A craft came down. There are three separate impact sites. Crew were more than were said. Sometimes people took three or four. The big debate about was anybody alive? Yes, there was. The pilot of the spacecraft was actually of a feminine disposition, and that creature was captured and died later on in captivity. So there are always stories and one person's version and another person's version. The version I have comes from British intelligence. So that is the version that I can give you.
And these were greys, were they? Or I can't quite remember the story now.
A version of greys. There are many sorts of greys. These greys did not have the big wraparound eyes that Hollywood likes to use, the big almond-shaped eyes. These greys had very small eyes, and they were sort of almost Asiatic-looking, 3.5 foot, 4 foot, something like that, four digits. And at the time, the reports that I've been privy to see, the eyewitnesses referred to them as like children, angelic faces like children. And that was the big thing that seemed to shock these Christians, because Roswell is a very strong, devout Christian community, very military. If you just look at the Roswell Daily Record newspaper, every day or Friday, it would print who would come into the military base and who had left. So something like that was quite shocking for them. And I can understand the impact. But I perhaps just would add, it's quite interesting that 1 week before the crash, the president authorized the head of the chaplain church within the armed forces to go and visit all of the bases in New Mexico. So 1 week before the situation, the head of the church within the military went and visited. And that was because, I believe, they were about to receive a shocking confrontation to the understanding of church and Bible, because they were about to find something that came from another world. And I think including the president, were very concerned that this would affect Christianity, affect the people's belief in the church, and hence why this chap was sent out. And that means that this was expected. And we must remember that the radar traces for over a week coming from the White Sands missile testing range had shown these alien spacecraft every day flying around. It was obvious what was going to happen. Remember that White Sands was the only place where a nuclear weapon could be attached to a rocket. That's what they were doing. They were attempting to deliver a nuclear bomb by a rocket. We take that for granted now, but back in 1947, that was big news.
Now, your parents both have some extraterrestrial genetics, correct?
I can't be sure of that. No, my father left the family when I was about 1 year old, and I never saw him again, so I couldn't say. My mother had the most amazing, almost telepathic memory, her ability to spell. That's why she was, I believe, brought into MI5 because her capability of spelling long, complex technical words and understanding technical jargon and blueprints and plans and diagrams was phenomenal. So that's where I think they got her. But I can't answer you on that question. I just simply don't know.
So your parents were just regular human parents, but you did have interaction with extraterrestrial beings who we spoke earlier were appearing to you in your environment and communicating with you, who refer to them as your parents, or themselves as your parents. Now, I believe one was reptilian and one was a mantis. Can you tell me a little about these two races of extraterrestrial beings? What are the two like?
Sure. Well, first of all, they're not extraterrestrial. They're extra-dimensional because they come through a time travel portal rather than a traditional spacecraft. I know that's probably splitting hairs, but it's important to them, and therefore I feel I need to put it across. The first creature that I was introduced to was in British English, mantid, but in American English, mantis. I'll use the word mantis from now on because it's an American show, and I respect and appreciate your viewers and listeners. So the mantis that appeared to me, I asked it, "What is your name?" And it said, "You should call me Mother." Well, when I was a little boy, I called it Mother or Mummy. And then as I got older, I just referred to it as Mum. Then a little while after the initial contact, a what we call a Draconis reptilian, that's what the researchers call them, Draconis reptilian appeared. And again, I asked the same question, what is your name? Who are you? What are you? And his reply was, well, you must call me your daddy. So when I was little, I referred to him as daddy. And as I grew up, I referred to him as dad. Of course, this leads to a great deal of confusion because people imagined that this was my biological parents. That's not accurate. They wanted to foster a connection with me because they considered me family. Therefore, they had taken the role of mother and father and I as their son. And this is how they wished it to be developed. Not to the exclusion of all else. Simply, I give an example. I think I was about 5 years old and I asked these creatures, why is it that because remember my biological father had left by the time I was 1 year old. And I said, why do I only have one daddy, but two mummies? Because I have a biological mother and I have this alien that wants me to call mother. So why do I only have one daddy, but I have two mummies? And the reply was, you needed a mother here on earth to give you food and to clothe you. So that was very interesting. So they had a very clear understanding of what my biological mother's role was. Her job was to feed me, give me clothes, and to keep me safe. But that was all her role. They were to do the rest of the role. So it's always bothered me whether my biological mother, well, how much she knew. Did she actually know the role that she was doing? Or did she only half guess it? And I think she only half guessed it because if a little boy comes into his mother and says, look, I've just seen a big flying saucer out there, then normally the mother would just throw her arms up in the air and say, you know, you're hallucinating, you're dreaming. What my mother would do, my biological mother, is give me a piece of paper and a pencil and say, draw it. And I draw it and she'd take it away with her. So that isn't the actions of somebody who doesn't know. That's the actions of somebody who does know and wants to know what her son has seen. So, at the time it just seemed normal. And as I got older and looked back on it, I began to realize that my mother must have been involved at some level.
So why is it that these two extra-dimensional entities are referring to you as their family? What's the family connection there? Is there some multidimensional genetic connection, or can you explain that connection?
I can try. It's very difficult because obviously we're talking about energies and we are in a three-dimensional world where everything is physical. What I understand is that the soul of my body is made up of three parts, one-third mantis, one-third reptilian, and one-third human, but in specifically hollow earth human. So I can see the link here because one part relates to the reptilian race, one part relates to the mantis race. And so these two characters, let's call them characters, were obviously deputized to represent their own groupings to connect with me. And because I have those elements of myself, then I was expected that those elements would connect with them very well. And it's an energy connection, not a physical connection.
So these beings, do they have a physical counterpart or a physical life in some other planetary body, or are they, do they exist entirely in this multidimensional universe?
Yeah, that's a really good question. In their own reality, which is fourth dimensional, they are physical, just like you and just like me. So in their own reality, that's what they perceive, just as we perceive physical solid objects. But when they leave that reality and they come into a third, which is a heavier density, we're a lower dimensional level, if they don't come fully into phase, then they would be perceived as a ghost. So you see the outline, the shape, and you can receive a telepathic message. But for all intents and purposes, they're not solid. You could literally put your hand through them. If they then carried on the process using super technology, they would then literally become solid in our reality, in which case you could touch them and feel them. They very rarely did that because to do so is to a risk chance of interaction with lots of other people or the intelligence or the military. So they would just come into phase. So there was just an outline and do what they needed to do, then go. Because when you physically come into a dimension, it takes longer to travel out again. It's a little bit, it's been explained to me a little bit like a diver. When a deep sea diver comes up from the seabed, he or she has to stop every so often so they don't get air bubbles in the blood. In the same way, to jump from one dimension to another instantly, unless you have some form of protective shielding around you, it's incredibly dangerous. So it's only on very rare occasions that these creatures would come through in the physical, but they have done from time to time.
Now, do they actually exist in a, in somewhere in a physical planet in our physical universe, or is it an entirely different universe that we couldn't perceive if we were to look in the sky?
The mantis come from a completely different reality, fourth dimensional. The galaxy is called the Sombrero Galaxy by astronomers. So if any of your listeners or viewers want to go and Google Sombrero Galaxy, they'll get some really cool pictures up on there. That's a good one to look at. That's a, I'm not saying that's the home planet of the mantis, but that is an outpost. That is a base where they're at. Interesting on the reptilian side because, again, I would have been about 5 or 6 when I was given the following information, which, did back up what I was reading when I was getting into my late teens and early 20s, that some of these reptilian creatures were purported to live somewhere in a military base under the earth. And how it was sold to me was that the creature called Mum, the mantis, was talking to me and said, well, I come from here, and then showed me a map of the Sombrero Galaxy, and then said, and Daddy, because I was a young kid, so he was referring to Daddy then. Daddy comes from inside the earth. His exact words to me were, Daddy lives inside the earth. So I had this vision of this underground city and him living in there. The reality is it's probably something not as grand as that. But nevertheless, I was left in no doubt that these reptilian creatures, or some of them, did exist somewhere in some form of facility in the earth. And I accepted it because when you're sort of 8, 9, 10 years of age, you know, you are very open to suggestions that people tell you. It's only later when I was reading other reports and thinking, well, that's just what I've been told. So yes, that's exactly where these creatures would be because they are close enough to access government, but not close enough to be stumbled upon by a rambler or a mountain climber. They are hidden away, but they are still in the earth and they still have connections to the highest in the land.
So they're referring to themselves as mother and father, mommy and daddy. Does that work in the same way as would be in a human civilization? Do they interact in some sort of relationship sense and produce an offspring energetically, or the one third that is, or the two thirds that is them, that's in you vibrationally? How does that work exactly? What's the relationship between the two of them?
No, it couldn't, because they're a different species altogether and they're just not compatible. And the other thing is they're both male, so it certainly wouldn't work. Although the mantis referred to itself as mum, it was male. Quite interesting, because as a 7-year-old child, my grandfather wanted me to learn the piano, something that high-end kids always have to learn, apparently. So he bought a piano and it was installed. And then the music teacher turned up and I was introduced to the music teacher. And the first thing I said is, "You're a man." And my mother just turned to him and said, "Sorry, it's not going to work." They had to get a woman. So I have always responded much more to the feminine energy than the male energy. So I can understand why this mantis creature portrayed itself as mum, because if it portrayed itself as a male, I would have had a problem, as I did with the reptilian creature. I always had to be extremely careful with the reptilian creature, because it had no sense of humor. It was very serious, and you had to be very careful what you communicated to it, because if you communicated the wrong, not just the wrong thing, but if you put the wrong emphasis on the wrong feeling or the wrong word, then you could completely change the sentence. You could completely change the tone of what you were trying to say. So although I only speak one language, I'm just imagining if I was to learn Native American or some other language that had elements of English in it, so I could understand it. But I had to be careful how I spoke, because it might be taken as an offense. So you always had to be on your guard when talking to him. Whereas with the mantis creature, I could be just relaxed and laid back, and there was no form of difficulty. In terms of the way they reacted together, they were very businesslike. Nobody outranked each other. So they seemed to be agreeing on most things. And on between my 5th and 7th birthday, I can't be sure, I was asked to choose which one of them I wished to interact with more than the other. And the mantis wore a purple robe, and the reptilian had a sword, what was called and is called the Great White Sword. And I was asked to hold the sword in my right hand, and was told very carefully, "Don't hold it at the edge, you'll cut yourself, hold it at the flat end." And I was told to hold the robe in my left hand, and I was then asked, "Choose, is it the sword or the robe, which do you choose?" And I lifted the purple robe up above my head and said, "I choose the purple robe." So I chose the mantis to associate with more than the reptilian. And from that moment onwards, then the mantis had much more say in when I was interacted with and the style of that interaction.
Now, the robe and the sword, so these were physical things, unlike them? They were not...
No, they had come... I was taken into another place. So this was one of those initiation ceremonies. It was very important, and I had to be there in the physical. So it was where I was physically taken, and both of those creatures were physical. They were not energy based. They were real solid creatures. And I saw this creature, and he had two sons, and one of the ceremonies, each son had to place his hand upon the shoulder of, so there were two brothers. So the smaller or the younger brother had to place his hand on the shoulder of his brother, and the elder brother had to place his hand on the shoulder of his father. Now, to give you some idea of the size, I couldn't do that. All I could do was touch his leg. That's how tall these creatures were. So I had to have this connection. You had to stand and make a connection. So I physically could only, the highest I could get was just above, between his knee and his hip. So that'll give you some idea. And I remember touching it, and the best way to describe it was like a pineapple. That's how the skin felt. And your viewers or listeners could hold a pineapple and rub your hand over a pineapple, because it's like scales. It's got different segments, and it felt rough and sharp like that. And I will always remember that to my dying day. That was an incredible thing. Whereas a mantis skin and was much more like a melon, smooth and shiny. So fascinating.
So tell me more about the personalities of these two beings, and what is the intention of each race, assuming that they're aligned with their race's intentions in working with you, or were they not?
It's very difficult from a human perspective to use the word personality. I think everything has a personality, but I would say they have an energy signature. That's a much better way of providing it. The mantis creature did not have a sense of humor, but understood the importance for humor in humans. In other words, when you speak telepathically, you don't need to use your hands. It is a fact of vocal creatures like ourselves here that we use our hands to reinforce or express. But telepathic creatures don't generally. And I was trained when I'm being telepathic, when I was having a telepathic conversation with them, I was trained not to verbally say anything, but I could use a hand movement if I wished to reinforce a particular point. And the mantis would do that, because that was understood, that that's what humans did. And the mantis was trying to make humans always feel at their ease. And when you look at the reptilian, they had absolutely no sense of humor at all, had no need of it. Tremendous psychic ability, would know what you were thinking before you even knew it yourself. There's no point in lying to one of those creatures, because they know. And it's all about ritual and ceremony. So there's a set way of doing something. You have to follow a protocol. It's rather like, you know, if you were with a genuine person in Tibet, you might want to sit and take tea, and you can't actually ask them a favor until you've sat and taken tea. And you've done that, the ritual, what we would say in Great Britain is the niceties, and then you would ask what you need. Well, it was very much like that with this creature. There was a set pattern you had to follow, and then it was appropriate to have a discussion. So in terms of personality, it had none, except it was a commander, it was a king, it was a leader, and it wanted absolute obedience. So if that is a personality, you really wouldn't want to take, because it wouldn't appreciate any of the beauty around it.
So is that the origin of a lot of the rituals that we have in the world culture, especially even in the UK, in government and secret societies, are very ritually based, right? So is that because of a reptilian influence or something else?
Well, you demonstrate to me your superior knowledge here, because you really have done your research. And it's very nice for me to be interviewed by somebody who is very knowledgeable. Yes, I mean, I remember as a kid watching some of the soap operas from America in the 50s and 60s, and every Sunday, the guy is out there washing his car. That is a ritual. Lawn, you know, mow the grass if you've got a piece of grass outside your garden, go and wash your car. Or if you have a bit of land, you put a big fence around it, you get a big dog, because you are protecting your bit of real estate. These are rituals and ceremonies given to us, and they breed in us a form of nervousness, because we are frightened or nervous that somebody will encroach onto our territory or take our land, and we wish to fight and defend what is ours. Now, let's not mix that up with patriotism. That's not to be mixed up with that. Many of the rituals and ceremonies that we have are given us as teachings by the reptilian race, not to control us, but because that's what they value. You know, they look on it and say, we do this, therefore you should do this, because it's good enough for us, it should be good enough for you. And by and large, the human race has accepted it and has woven it into its culture and does it. It's very negative. You'll find that males are far more down that road than females. Females are very rebel against a lot of the control elements, and they like to be more free and easy. And that is why the reptilians, it's a male patriarchal dominated society, because the males have the structure picture, and the female's advice at the back. So you can imagine the king sitting on the throne and then the female whispering in his ear, don't forget to do this. And that's the culture.
So what's the intention of these two races in working through you? And obviously you've been in a public office and you're becoming quite prominent in this, in these various movements. Why, I'm curious about what is their individual intentions for the human race and the planet and their intention for working through you to facilitate those intentions.
That's probably a question that, to be honest, we could spend an hour on. So I'm going to try and answer it as quickly as I can, but without losing any of the very vital detail. The two creatures do share an agenda. I give you an analogy. Let us say that it's always about oil. So let's say we find some oil off some country in the deep sea. No one country is capable of bringing that oil up. So the Germans make very good optics. So you go to the Germans, you say, make us a camera that can go down so we can see where the oil is. And the Americans make very good drills. So you make us a drill. The British make very good sonar, et cetera, et cetera. And you build a group around you into a loose franchise because the overall goal is to extract the oil. So what we have is a reptilian and a mantis group working together for an overall goal, which is the engagement working with humanity. But that's where it ends, because certainly the group of mantis that I associate with have a very different agenda in terms of the future for humanity and how it works. Now, you would be mistaken to be believing that these creatures are working through me. That's actually not the case. What's happening is that my experiences on this planet are being relayed back to them, and the decisions that I make personally, energetically, have either a negative or a positive effect upon these creatures' development. I can categorically tell you that the reptilian group, as we call them, don't seem to want to evolve. They seem to be quite happy where they are, whereas the mantis group wish to evolve. And I think that the mantis group and the human group are quite closely linked. In other words, if the human group can evolve, there's a very good chance that the mantis group can, and I would presume the reptilian group would be left behind. So ultimately, what we have here is a situation where I am undertaking my life, whatever I choose to do under free will, and those choices are fed back and they energetically put pressure on others to either face up to my decisions and make a change or ignore them. So that is the case. Now, I know that there's many in the military and spy networks who are aware of that, because in, I think it was 2013, I was invited to a tour of, it's actually an American secret installation in Great Britain. It's the only three-phased array in the world. In North America, there is a two-phased array, but there is only the one three-phased array run by America, but jointly sort of staffed by British because it's on British land. And I got a three-hour guided tour around a top-secret space radar. And it's actually called a space radar base. Now, you'd have to ask yourself, if I was completely mad, I'd made up that my grandfather worked for the CIA and my mother worked for NSA, would you really let someone making those public statements come around your radar base for 3 hours on a guided tour? And this was a huge game changer, because suddenly even the hard-nosed people in the established media realized there was something big going on here. So their editor was saying, go and, you know, make this guy look a fool. And then suddenly the Ministry of Defense and the American military authorized me a 3-hour tour. And I had people very high up from the established media phoning me at home on my landline and my home phone and saying, what's going on? You know, we've been told to make life difficult for you, but you know, you're actually being looked after. So these people all backed off, and suddenly within the space of about a week, all the attacks from the established media just disappeared completely. And the way they dealt with me was just to ignore me. And I did have a tour of a space radar base called Filingdales, not very far from where I live. And I was probably the only non-military person there. Everyone else was from the Air Force or the Navy or the infantry. There was a group of 12 of us who got the tour. And at the end of it, I was given a really nice commemorative little coin. Nobody else was given it. It was very interesting. I do talk about it on my videos, and I still have this because people still say I don't believe it. So I can bring the coin out and say, there you go. And I always remember when the guy presented it to me, and he said, look, he said, the Americans insist that I take everybody's name we present these to. I said, you know my name. He said, I know, but just give me your name. So each of these coins, there's only a limited 500 made in the world. Only 500 in the whole, on the whole of the world. And each coin was numbered. So he had to write the number of the coin next to my name. And what he said was, this isn't your property. It's the American property. You cannot sell it. Pass it on to your next of kin. So it's yours to keep and pass on, but you cannot sell it. It belongs to America. But it is a token of friendship between us and you. And it's a medal. A commemorative coin, and I was the only one who got that. So I'm very, very privileged and proud to have been presented that by both America and Britain. So that's good.
So why would these two countries and their agencies allow you to go on living, let's say, if they know you're protected and you're going to publicly share a lot of this knowledge that you've obtained, it seems, and how is it you're being protected exactly?
I think that, well, I'm sure that the agency's role is to observe me and monitor me, but not to interfere. That is their role. And I'm very sanguine about it. The funny story I'll tell you is it was actually just Christmas morning, 10:30 in the morning, and I'd sent an email or a text, I can't remember, to a friend saying, you're going to come up and visit me for New Year's Day, you know, that'd be really nice. And my friend sent me a message back saying, you know, yes, I can manage that. And I wrote back and I said something like, oh, that's great. You're going to be coming up to visit me. Within about 5 seconds on my cell phone, a message appeared which said, this is an ungrammatical sentence. Now that actually didn't come in as a message. It appeared as if I typed it. So somebody 24 hours a day, 365 days of a year, monitors my cell phone. And I know the situation. This guy, it's Christmas morning, his probably wife and kids are at home. He's sitting there bored out of his mind, and he just couldn't resist it, and he had to access my cell phone and send me a message. It wasn't rude. It wasn't nasty. And it just helped to remind me that I am monitored all the time, just as this broadcast will be. But they won't take it down because it's not their responsibility to take it down. Their responsibility is to observe and watch. You asked about who is protecting me, something more powerful than them. And that's why they don't get involved. The only issue I have sometimes, occasionally, is with some of the secret societies who object to some of my deprogramming work that I do with people. There are people who escape some of these very difficult satanic groupings, and then I deprogram them. And sometimes individuals, it doesn't come from the head office, but some of the individuals don't like that and try and be difficult. But that's just the game. That's just the way it is.
So by higher up, you're talking about extra-dimensional beings or off-planet beings of some kind, or are you talking about a physical, earthly higher up?
No, because there isn't anything on Earth that's powerful enough to protect me. My human mother once told me that there were two lists of people's names. One list that the American government held all the names and addresses of anybody who was bona fide who had alien connection. There was a second list where that government, the American government, had given over responsibility of that individual. So it doesn't matter whether you were born in Paraguay or Paris, France, or in Great Britain. It was the American government that controlled that aspect of it. So the off-world alien group would send a list. I don't know how that list was delivered, but they would send a list saying, we want these people. You'd have no responsibility for these people. And my human mother did say that she understood that I was on this second list. Now, sure, if I go too fast and I get a speeding ticket, I'll do that. I have to pay my taxes. But that's where it ends. And time again, where a situation has occurred, I have been treated so magnificently well by the British police force. It's just unbelievable. People often say to me, well, who are you paying your taxes to? We don't get the sort of service you get. And, you know, it's only when you compare, and I sort of went public with the stories, which are all traceable because you can do a Freedom of Information Act. And the way that the system responds to me is very different. And that's quite apparent. And so, whatever is protecting me is more powerful than anything on earth. Otherwise I would have been taken out. I would be dead in a ditch. No, I wouldn't be dead in a ditch. You usually have a car crash, an auto crash, don't you? Or you fall out of a 12-story building or something like that. And here I am, I've got past my 50th birthday, and I'm hopeful for a good few years left.
Now, you mentioned that the mantid race is interested in evolving, but that the a reptilian race that calls itself your father is very happy where it is right now. So what exactly is their agenda in more detail if it's not to evolve with regard to being on Earth and interacting with human beings?
Right. I'd just correct it a little bit. They're not actually happy where they are. They're incredibly miserable, but they can't bring themselves to get out of the hole they're in. Their whole agenda is to maintain the status quo. It's a bit like the Illuminati. They wish to maintain their position because they have certain benefits where they are, and they wish to maintain them and not lose them. And if you are in a mindset where you've always been in charge, you've always been the leaders or the rulers, and then to say, okay, we're going to give that up and we're going to be equal with the same people who only yesterday we were oppressing, that you've got to be hugely evolved to be able to say, I wish to make that change. It's a bit like in 3D terms, somebody winning $1 million on the lottery and then giving it all away to charity. It does happen, but most people wouldn't do that. They might give some away, but they would keep most of it. So this is the thing about giving away what you perceive as power for something that you can't weigh. You can't value eternal happiness. You can't weigh or value unconditional love. If you are sitting in a physical world with physical power, to give that up for something that you can't see, touch, or weigh is very, very big leap of faith. And so an unevolved creature can't do it. So they can't do it.
So what makes them miserable? Just the absence of physical love and these things that they can't perceive? Or do they even have a concept of why they're unhappy?
They don't. Physical love is not seen in the same way. Physical sex is understood, but not physical love. They don't understand the word love. They understand the word sex. What makes them unhappy is that they are surviving on a world of fear. In other words, their whole world is about a power structure, which may or may not come down. There's no friendship. Everything is for a rank or hierarchical command structure. They live for authority. And so there isn't a balance in their life. Everything is militarily dominated and through very, very rigid structure. And if you don't have any downtime in your life, you are going to get incredibly frustrated and you're going to get incredibly miserable. You know, as human creatures, we can go out, if we're lucky, and go into the woodlands, into the forest or up a mountain or into a desert or by the sea. And we can enjoy and experience these feelings. And for us, that sort of reinvigorates the soul. But if you can't understand those things, then you have no need for them as you see it. But you're never feeding that part of your soul. And as a result of that, you become more miserable because you're caught in a whirlpool that's going round and round and round, smaller and smaller. And if they only just saw that their escape is to give up the power struggle and to try and share equally, but they can't do that. So it's they brought it on themselves. It's their own misery. And I just shake my head, but I don't ever shake it in front of him, because that is an offensive sign. To shake your head is a very offensive sign. I often wondered that I should be asked to do a manual. I probably don't need to, because they have their own, but an etiquette manual for the military. You know, when they first, and they do, they connect with these creatures reasonably regularly, and certainly the Vatican do. There is a protocol, there is a way of doing it. The Rothschilds and the Rothschild family would be very familiar with it. There are certain things that you can and can't say, and the way you should move. And you know, you're forever, a British word here, living on tenterhooks. You are always thinking, no, I mustn't do this, I mustn't do that. It's very one-sided, and yeah, if you're living like that all the time, no wonder these creatures are miserable.
So how long have they been in control of the Earth civilizations?
That's a really good question. It's a really good question, because there are a number of facets or angles to that answer. I think that we could probably kick them off at about 220 or 230,000 years ago. Certainly around 20,000 years ago, 18,000 BC, they had a bit of an issue, because another alien group began to come here and take control. Genuinely say that they believe this to be their play garden about 220-230,000 years. And as humanity has developed, certainly from Assyrian times, the beginning of the city-states, Babylon, Sumeria, Egypt, then the opportunities that they had grew. Because as the human population grew, the opportunities for exploitation grew. And as humanity grew and became more powerful, they had to disappear underground, because if you only number a few thousand, but your human population is many millions, then you're outnumbered. So it is better to play the hide and seek game and to control covertly. So the days of the overt, this is me, I stand here in front of 500 of you and you do what I tell you, have gone. Because you can't stand in front of a population of 6 billion people and say, do this, because you'll just be trampled to death. So that's why they moved underground. As the human population expanded, they felt it better to manipulate through their leaders. So today we have presidents and prime ministers. We have leaders of great corporations. We have royal family members in some countries. These are the people they need to have access to, because these are the creators of policy. You know, lawmakers create rules and laws that the ordinary citizens have to live by. So it's no point in controlling the citizens. It is important to control the lawmakers, because through them you control the planet. So it's very simple. You know, if you play a game of Monopoly, you know, the person that's got, I don't know what it is in Britain, it's Mayfair and Park Lane. I don't know what the best properties in America are, but the person who holds those cards, everybody wants to be their friend. So that's how it works.
So this 200,000 years ago, were these reptilians what were known as the Anunnaki, or was the Anunnaki the other race that they had to struggle with, or what's the story behind that?
Well, for many viewers and listeners, maybe the term Anunnaki is something that they're not familiar with. It is actually a mixed race, and just as very clever scientists on Earth have made clones, Dolly the sheep, of course, some 20 years ago, and many since then. So these creatures were able to combine what they saw as the best elements of one race with another race. And by mixing the two races, they could make something that looked very human and could pass as human. You know, if you were a pharaoh in ancient Egypt, if you look like a bug-eyed monster, then you won't get anyone to pour the wine for you, because they'll all be hiding in the cellar. So you have to look reasonably human so that people don't shrink away from you. But you have to have enough alien about you so that your loyalty is always to that other group. So the Anunnaki are a mixture race from the Orion's Belt area. And in British English, I would say Cyrus. In American English, you guys would say serious. One was very male-dominated and one was very female-dominated. And so if you take these two forms and you splice them with some human genetics, you begin to see some very interesting creatures through history who look human but look a bit odd. And that's what we've got.
And what were these two races? Were they reptilian races or that were spliced together with human genetics?
Yes, absolutely. That is why time and time again, in nearly every country on the earth, the dragon has an important symbol. Now, Great Britain is made up of a number of smaller countries, and one country called Wales, its national flag is a dragon. And those who haven't gone to history college would be fascinated to know that in the ancient Roman world, the sign of the legion was the main infantry unit of the Roman Empire, used an eagle, a gold eagle on a standard, which seems just about right. But around about 250 AD, and nobody says why, it was replaced by a dragon. And that's incredible, that the history of the great Roman Empire should suddenly do away with an eagle and replace it with a dragon standard. The Chinese are very into dragons. Most countries have dragons. The reptilian race, rightly or wrongly, considers its forefathers to have been dragons. Now, that may just be fanciful, mystic belief, but it doesn't matter because that's what they believe. So if they believed it, they would then have told the people that they were interacting with on Earth throughout history, and you must honor the dragon. You must honor the dragon. So here and there, we see suddenly dragons appearing, and that is because of this direct connection between a reptilian race, or a half-reptilian, half-human race, put into positions of power, who then can make the laws and say, right, well, we're going to have a building and we're going to call it the Dragon Hall, or we're going to have this, that, and the other. And that's how you do it. You do it not all in one go because you upset people. You do it gradually over many years.
Yeah, I find it interesting. Now, even the Catholic religion originated with Daganism, right, which is a worship of a reptilian being of some kind. And the Pope still wears a mitre that looks like a fish head, right?
Well, the important thing is that in recent times, the church has constructed its sales pitch in a way that doesn't upset people. But if you were to go back in history, you would find that a number of practices that were commonplace would not be acceptable. So it's about marketing. If you are going to sell something, you have to sell it in a way that people will buy. And so religion, if anything else, is a product. We know it's a product because at the end of the sing-song, before you're allowed to go out the doors, a plate or a box is passed around and you have to put money in there. Well, that's a corporation. That's selling. I haven't got anything against religion except the fact that it seems to be about money. I once saw somebody having to crawl on their hands and knees barefoot to a church, up a church stairs, because they'd done something wrong. How is that good? I don't understand that. But what I do understand is that God is real. I know it's real because the alien creatures have said to me there is a God. They don't call God God. Their term for God is the undying creator. So they're telling me there's a God. I know there's a God. I don't need somebody in a very expensive robe to tell me there's a God. And by the way, if I want forgiveness, I have to go to church. And if I'm, you know, I really say I'm very sorry, this church man will forgive me. I don't want his forgiveness. Others may do, but I don't. So I don't have a problem with God. I have a problem with religion.
Now, I watched one of your presentations where you make the connection between a lot of military societies and secret societies and the various reptilian insignias they use. And I'm also curious about even the car maker Alfa Romeo has some kind of a dragon eating a human being, right? So are these all connected directly to the reptilian race that you spoke of, that you're that refers to itself as your father? Or is it just now there are reptilian races that are more benevolent, are there not, or are they all malevolent?
No, there are a number which are not just negative. There are some which are independent, and there are a small number of very positive reptilian groups. There is what we call the native reptilians. This is probably a stone too far for many people, but there is a native group of reptilians who are reasonably beneficial to the human race. And there are a number of renegades, groups that have had enough of the situation. And we've talked a little bit about why you might be so distressed being a Draconis reptilian. But there are groups of factions that broke away, just as in 1944, the high command of the German army tried to blow up Adolf Hitler with a bomb. So we are seeing very similar things occurring now where lesser ranking members of the family are attempting to destabilize the ruler because they see themselves as a Titanic going down. In terms of multinational companies, suppose I was half reptilian and half human, and through my connections, I was made head of a big corporation, the first thing I would do is change the logo, because I would want something that represents my proud family lineage. You know, and many of these logos are steeped in history and can't be changed. So that's why many of them don't contain more reptilian type devices, because it would be too much of a shock. But in those cases where they have been changed, then there is usually some symbology hidden in them. It's good detective work for people to dig it out.
And you mentioned earlier that, that this reptilian race is very unhappy because of the rigidity of their structure and that they work too much and so on. Is that why we've ended up creating a society because of their influence where people work in offices and cubicles and work too much and really don't have very much leisure time, and even their leisure time seems like not very happy time. Is this their creation intentionally that we have the society?
Yes, one of the most or the most important countries in the world is America. I'm not an American myself, but I have absolutely the most important place is North America. It's where the hearts and minds for the forthcoming decisions will be made. Great Britain is very important from an energy-based, magical, historical. British Isles are very, very important like that. But it is America that make the decisions. You have a population of, I believe, 230 million. You only have 1 million cops. You have to control your population. And one of the ways to do that is to split people up and isolate them. It was the Germans in about 1937 that discovered what we call compartmentalization. In fact, when the German scientists were building the very first guided missile, which was called Fritz 10 or Fritz X missile, it was the very first missile in the world where you fired it and watched a television picture. We take that for granted now, but we're talking back in the 1930s. The Germans, Adolf Hitler was in power by then, decided that they would have these factories, and not only would the factories not talk to each other, but each department would be split into sub-departments, and nobody would tell the other person what they were doing. So if you were building a propulsion system, you had no idea what you were building it for. So nobody could put the picture together except the guy at the top. And in the same way, in the human race, particularly the mechanized Western world, the industrialized world, we now are all individual, working individually, sending our information in to a bigger plan. It is exactly the same thing. And occasionally an employee gets wind of something and begins to put a bigger picture together. It may have nothing to do with the topic tonight, but it may to do with a merger or a takeover. And they suddenly realize that a massive game of chess or a game of checkers is being played around them, and that nobody knows what's going on. So it's something the Germans gave to the Americans, and the Americans used very effectively. So yes, you're absolutely right.
Now, do you see that changing? Now, I've heard you speak about timelines and so on, and that we're currently on a timeline that's heading in a more positive direction. So what do you see happening in our future, and how long away is that future? I know it's a lot of people don't like to make predictions as to specific dates, but in a general or more conservative sense, let's say the next 10 to 20 years, what kind of future do you see us heading into, and are we moving away from that type of a society?
Well, over the last 15, perhaps 20 years, we've been on a much more positive timeline. There have been, there were three attempts, and what I call them, railroad jumps. If you imagine you're on a railroad and someone, you hit the points and you jump to another railroad. So there have been three different changes. We're now on a very positive line, which we can't be taken off from. So the negative forces are saying, all right, we're on this timeline. How can we make the best of it from our perspective? I'm quite happy to give you some dates. I made predictions about this year, which have come right. Predicted the economic situation in China, a number of other things. So I can tell you that we've got another 2.5 years of very difficult times. We have another 2.5 years of terrorist attacks, 2.5 years of countries suffering huge economic issues. And then at the end of the 2.5 years, there will be a substantial change in the way people think, in the way they value, and the way they question. If you go onto the high street, you go onto the to your broadwalk, you'll find everyone's disillusioned with the government. But that's as far as it goes. Nobody wants to push it any further. I'm not talking about armed battles. I don't want that. That's not what I want. What I want is people to actually realize that they're being tricked. Nearly every step of the way, they're being given false information. And all I ask of people is ask your true self, is what you're hearing right? Because in 2.5 years' time, a veil is going to be lifted. It's very hard to describe this. It is not a physical thing, but people will just know the truth and they'll start rejecting what's on offer. If everybody on a Monday morning stopped going to the Walmart, Walmart would have to change the way they did business. If you found out that your local store was paying a particular employee only half of what it paid everybody else, and if all those people who customers of that store went and sat outside the front door, within 1 hour, that employee would have the same wage as everybody else. Not a gun was fired, not a punch was thrown, but this is the power that people have, and the system does not want the viewers, the listeners, to realize the real power they have. You know, from a personal perspective, if everybody sat outside their gas station for one day, the prices at the pump would come right down. As long as people just keep paying the bills, doing what they do, why would the system change? So I would say 2.5 years and we will see some very interesting changes.
So that's quite a substantial awakening that you're talking about, because it doesn't seem like the mainstream is anywhere near that, although those of us who are part of this conversation obviously are waking up quite a bit. So in terms of extraterrestrial contact, do you anticipate any time in the foreseeable future where we will have physical contact, or is this things like this conversation and this ever-growing community of people who are opening up to multidimensional contact and also interacting maybe in similar ways as you are, is this what that contact is going to be, but not necessarily physical?
Right, you start off with a statement and then you ask a question, but I'll take the statement. Imagine a tower block, and then three floors of the tower block are in control, and the 120 stories underneath are not part of that control. The three floors still send out information and false information 24 hours a day, but it doesn't mean that the rest of the tower block are actually taking any notice of them. And there comes a point when the guys on the top three floors actually realize that they're redundant, because nobody underneath them is taking the blindest bit of notice to them. That is a situation we are almost at now. You have the elite who control the mass media, and they are pumping out this stuff, but it's having less and less effect on the public. And, you know, if I was a guy working in the established media, I'd be really having a problem, because I would having to push a story which I knew wasn't true, that I know wasn't being bought by the public, but hey, I'm getting a paycheck for it. So that's a situation we have. Now, in terms of when will we have contact, I understand the question, but I have to be a bit pedantic and say we've already had contact. What you mean is global contact, when everybody actually understands the truth. Over a number of years now, this ultimatum has been given to the leaders of the major countries of the world that they need to tell the truth. And if they don't tell the truth, that will be taken from them and the people of the world will be told the truth. The difficulty there is that if that responsibility is taken away from the governments, they lose the way they manage the situation. There undoubtedly will be some panic. There will be, but there won't be anything like the panic that they pretend there will be. I think people are okay with the idea of someone who's a bit like us, has tremendously big technology, and you know, wants to talk to us, because the fear factor is something that I want to address. If these creatures wanted to destroy the Earth, they'd have done it when we had bows and arrows. They haven't done it. So they're obviously there are no intention on destroying the Earth. So it's not about destroying the Earth. The negative forces wish to maintain the status quo, their control system. There is another group of off-world creatures who actually wish a more free and open society. So this is where we're getting the problems between those who basically manage the planet and those that don't like the way that the human race is basically a slave race. And that may sound really shocking, but you know what? You get born, you get a birth certificate, just like a cow when it's going to be grown and go to market, it gets a little certificate. And they'll look at that certificate and they'll say, okay, he's born of a white race. He's a middle-class family. He's equal, if he lives till he's 60, the tax we're going to get from this person is this. That person is worth that much to us. And then, you know, you have to pay to live in a house. You have to pay to eat. You have to pay to keep warm. You have to pay to go out anywhere. You have to pay for the planet you're born on. And then when you get sick and ill, they say, oh, you're going to have to go into a retirement home. You haven't got enough in your pension plan. Tell you what, sell your house, give us your house, and you can have the retirement home. So you leave the Earth with nothing, unless you're super rich, and then you can pass on something. But most people, they leave the Earth with very little. So we have a situation which is not very fair. It's not very good. Unless you're the top 1% of the 99% of the population, and then you're doing very well. So there are a number of off-world people who are frankly sick of it. And they have interceded over the last few years to redress the balance. It is for humankind to develop and throw the shackles off. You know, we can't expect Colonel Custer to come galloping in with the 7th Cavalry to save the human race. The human race is the 7th Cavalry and has to save itself. And this is the disempowerment that humans have been programmed into, always looking for somebody else to save the day. They look for a leader. They look for somebody. They never look inside themselves. And that's something that we need to address.
This is something that's been inbred in our society and culturally and psychologically for hundreds of thousands or 100,000 years at least, right? So how does the human race overcome that, in your opinion?
Yes, you're absolutely right. Sometimes it was deliberately put there, sometimes it just occurred naturally. The strong man made it to the top. So we all got the impression of a very strong man was the right man to lead us. Because it isn't about strength, it's about your belief. It's about values and judgment. In other words, if we make a judgment that what we're seeing around us is wrong, then it doesn't matter who we put in, whether it's Democrat or Republican, Conservative or Labour, it doesn't seem to actually change anything. Yeah, sure, things are tinkered around the edges and a very unpopular policy from last year is changed. But the fundamental change doesn't happen. The taxes still go up. The pollution still increases. It's harder and harder to feed and clothe your kids. Those things don't change. That's what needs to change. And that isn't a strong man that's required. That's a root and branch change. If you've got a big house, knock it down, take out the foundations and rebuild it again. The established media never told the truth about the revolution in Iceland. They never said it on America or British television, except with the very smallest covering. And your viewers and listeners may be surprised to know that ordinary men and women on the street, went in to the lawmakers' chamber, the Icelandic government, and physically threw out their lawmakers, physically grabbed them and threw them on the street. And also your listeners and viewers may be surprised to know that they have a constitution. We all have a constitution. Icelandics wrote it on Facebook. They wanted everybody to participate in that. That was a revolution that was never, ever reported, because if you showed what happened in Iceland, it could happen anywhere else. So we don't have a very free press, but the human spirit is indomitable. The human spirit cannot be broken. And so the human spirit sees all this adversity around it and cries out for an answer. And it is a matter of time before that call is heard and all individuals decide that enough is enough and they're going to do something about it. It nearly happened in what we would call the flower power age, the hippie period. You nearly had your government toppled. It nearly happened, but it was infiltrated. So there are precedents in the past history in terms of historic actions that can occur. And talking about presidents, finally, JFK was, interestingly enough, actually, the Institute for Foreign Affairs, or the Council for Foreign Relations, as it is now. Do you know that every president of America has been a member of the Council for Foreign Relations except two presidents? And one was Ronald Reagan and one was JFK, and both of them were shot. And I think that tells you a great deal about just how much independence people are, no matter how good President Obama is. And actually, he's a good man. He is surrounded by people who put him under impossible pressure. And this is the reaction. That's why we can't rely on somebody to come and do it for us. We have to do it ourselves. So that will happen in the next 2.5 years. We'll see some big changes.
Now, I've been hearing some talk about China taking over the Federal Reserve and Federal Reserve notes no longer being issued in the near future. Do you have any direct information to validate any of that?
Yes. This is a story being put around as a trying to go between total meltdown for the American situation. The total world debt is 199 trillion as of January this year. Debt isn't a problem. I'm not going to bore your viewers and listeners with lots of facts and figures, but debt is never a problem. It's not how much money a country owes. It's how much profit that country is making. Because if you're running up a debt, but you're still financially sound, it doesn't matter, because you can buy your way out of debt. What we're seeing is productivity collapsing, debt increasing. The Greece situation, 177% debt as related to gross national product. In other words, they can never buy themselves out of it. They're done forever. That's the problem. People aren't talking about that. That's the reality of it. So when you understand that paper notes are valueless, you have to look for what's real wealth. Now, this year, I predicted in January, February, I said there was a real chance that you could have had an economic collapse in America, and that the two possibilities left open to America were the Fed raising interest rates. But if you raised interest rates, whilst that would support savers, it would absolutely crush and crucify just about everybody else, which wouldn't have helped. The only other alternative was to talk to a handful of men, and they are men, who have real wealth. So if you are the owner of a diamond mine, and that diamond mine is worth $1 billion a year, but not paper dollars, real dollars, because they're diamonds, and you deposit that in a bank, it isn't just a billion that you've deposited, because you've deposited the future wealth of that diamond mine. Now, if that diamond mine is projected to have a life of 20 years, that might be a value of $20 billion. So if you get enough people holding real estate who can pledge their bonds for a 3-month period, that boosts the American economy in a real way. The man on the street, the woman on the street, they don't see the benefit of that. The coffee is still the same price, tastes the same. But from the huge financial houses, America seems much more secure. And this is what they've done. They've done a deal where these guys are going to put the money in to an American bank for 3 months, see it through the fall, because traditionally the fall is always when economies take a hit, and then pull the money out. Now, you will know that some people are not falling for this. The governor of Texas has passed legislation in his own state and has written to President Obama asking for his share of the federal gold to be returned to the Lone Star State. In other words, he's saying there's a big collapse coming and we want our share of the gold. It's quite complicated, but all the American states are entitled to a percentage of the gold reserve. And that is why Jade Helm paraded up and down the streets of Texas. That is why the governor ordered his own National Guard to tag along behind the Jade Helm regular army to keep an eye on them. The governor knows what's happening, and also in California, targeted by Jade Helm, because Texans are tough, no-nonsense people who won't be pushed around. You'd think the Californians are different. They are. But they are guys and girls who won't be pushed around because they're alternative. And their view is, I don't believe you. I don't trust you. The way we're coming at it is different, but both Texas and California are a thorn in the side of the federal government. So you have to understand that there are a number of reasonably key people who can see what's coming and are trying to position their states in a reasonably strong position. We talked about China. The real issue here is the formation of a new currency, predominantly between Russia and China, which is a gold-backed currency. Now, I don't want people to panic because that's not what this is about. If I'm in America and I go and buy the famous cup of coffee, that'll be the same until the coffee beans run out and I have to import more coffee beans. Okay, we don't want your money because there's no gold behind your money. So it'll cost you twice as much. So what would happen under circumstances that any product that was imported, the price would go up, but any domestically created product, the price would go down. You've got China, India, Russia, and a host of other countries who have all signed up for a new gold-backed economy. And even the woman who's in charge of the International Monetary Fund, which is an American proxy, has actually said that the International Monetary Fund is quite happy to work with China. So there you go. And Great Britain has actually asked to be part of this new group. So it's like people leaving the sinking ship. So America is the only country, and one other, I think it was Australia. I think it was America and Australia, the only two countries who categorically said this is a bad idea. Every other country in the world has said this is a great idea. So we see some huge change. That won't be reported in the national media, but it will happen, and there will be a currency of a worldwide range backed by gold. And if I was a manufacturer of autos or farm machinery, what am I going to do? Am I going to deal with someone that's got real gold behind them or somebody that's got nothing behind them? This is the choice. The American fleet, the largest fleet of any country on the world, Pacific, Atlantic, wherever they are, they no longer buy their oil in dollars. And they no longer buy the oil from America because they do not want to be in a position where they can't keep the fleet going. The fleet must always be at sea, and I agree with that. And so they know what's coming. So everyone who knows is making a position of change. What's unfair is that the ordinary person in the street knows nothing about this. And when it happens, they're going to say, well, nobody told me. So that's why I have a little website and I do a monthly newsletter and I try and get the facts out to people. It's up to them whether they listen to me or not.
So you're referring to BRICS at this point with the new currency, right?
Yes and no. At the moment, it's called that. It probably will be called something else. But ultimately, yes, it's a method of currency that will be equated with gold. In other words, no more currency will be created than there are gold blocks or bricks in the bank. So if you've got 10 tons of gold, whatever that value is, you cannot exceed the paper or the coin money. It is a very interesting concept because it's not new. It goes back to the 1920s when both America and Great Britain were on the gold standard. That's actually what it meant, being on the gold standard. You could go into a bank, sounds incredible now, doesn't it? And you could put some paper money on the counter and you could say, I want the equivalent of that in gold. You could do that and it was perfectly legal. And so to this generation, that seems crazy. But that's why people had confidence in money. That's why inflation was so low. That's why you could, pay wages, and the wages bought you enough food and clothes for your family. It's crazy now. We have a situation where you get paid on Friday, and probably by the end of the week, the same thing in the shop has gone up 10 cents or 20 cents. Why? Because it's raining? Because it's Tuesday? No, because somebody's greedy and wants to make money. So, as I've always said, I have no problem with making a profit. I have a problem with greed. And we have a number of very greedy corporations who are strangling small businessmen and women because they want to dominate. And as they dominate and become global, if they take a hit, then the collapse across the chain is going to be huge. Because if you have small independent business people running stores or shops, they can weather the storm. But the great big giant, once he gets a hit, there's going to be some issues. So I am concerned for America simply because power rests or lies in the hands of just a handful of people. And if a couple of them decide that there's no longer any money to be made in America, it will have quite a devastating effect.
So you're not seeing any direct impact at the moment toward the U.S. Financial system or Federal Reserve banking system because they're not willing to participate in what's going on globally. Is that so? So a lot of these rumors going on about a shift in the Federal Reserve are, in your opinion, unfounded?
No, I think that there are debates being held. In fact, I know there are some very, very worried people asking how they can get out of this mess, that economic mess, because the last thing they want to do is to destroy the very empire that keeps them in position. Now, the animal, the ostrich, sticks its head in the sand, and that's exactly what they're doing. So they're doing a lot of talking, but not doing a lot of action. What they really need to do is to sit down with their arch enemies, which are China and Russia, and say, how can we work together? But they can't do it. I know that the people who research this are familiar with what I'm about to tell you, but there may be many listeners who are not. A few years ago, because America shockingly owes China a lot of money, and you can't understand that because America won two world wars. But anyway, it does. It owes China a great deal of money, and China said, we want the money, and America got all the notes ready to pay them, and China said, this is a few years ago, that's valueless. We want gold. So the Americans said, well, it's okay. We've got Fort Knox. Absolutely true. Sent in the forklift trucks, loaded the gold up, sent it off. Well, the Chinese are very, as we say in Britain, very canny people. They're very astute. And they knew the real economic situation. They drilled in to these gold bars and found, I think they were made of iridium or radium. I can't remember what the metal was. But ultimately, they were just gold plated. Didn't cause a third world war. And your listeners and viewers can go and Google this to see that I'm not talking a load of nonsense. The Chinese said, okay, you don't have any gold to back you up. We want real estate. And that's why Boston Harbor belongs to the Chinese. So they didn't pay for it. They were given it. So every ship that loads and unloads in Boston Harbor has to pay a levy. And that goes to the China, and then there's a port authority fees, et cetera, et cetera. That's why the Chinese are not buying parts of America. They've been given it. But, of course, the American government can't say we've just given Manhattan away to the Chinese. They've got to say, they pay top dollar for it. America owes China an incredible amount of money. China doesn't want the money. It wants the land, the real estate. And that's frightening to be in a country that your heritage – think of the founding fathers. Think of the proudness of the founding fathers. Your country's been sold to Chinese people because the people running your country haven't managed the budget. If you're a very poor man and wife and a couple of kids, and your responsibility is your children. And so you have to make sure that the money you get, make sure they get their food and their clothing and then go to school and get their school books and you make ends meet. But it's like, the government saying, well, we don't care about the children. We don't care. We'll sell the country off, or we'll sell our furniture off. So when you look at it from a local perspective, it's not very good. And it seems to be that the people at the top are so disconnected from the ordinary men and women that they do not understand how they live. And they don't understand that their decisions have great impact on their lives. So all I would say is that in 2.5 years' time, a lot of what I'm saying now is going to hit home, not because I've said it, but because these ordinary people will see it for themselves. I know in many states in America, bread has doubled in price over the last few months. I know that because so many people tell me what's going on in the states. Prices have risen and outstripped wages. It's not a good situation to be in. So I wish that the people in power would just, you know, give a little bit more back to the people.
So in 2 years, you see a big shift. At what point do you think that we're going to have a shift toward a better society? I mean, obviously changing to a gold-backed currency is a step in the right direction, but it's still a currency and it's still a worldwide system where people have to work all day to make money, to make ends meet. It's not really an ideal society. So when do you see, or at what point do you see us heading in a more ideal direction, maybe where we have free energy technology and people have more freedom to not have to work so much?
Yes. Sounds impossible, doesn't it? Because we've all been brainwashed to believe it's impossible. It actually is possible. I give you a scenario. I do this at many of my conferences to try to put people into the position of making a decision. We are programmed to believe that you can't have anything unless you pay for it. Often it never shows up on my videos because they don't film it. I wish it did. But at many of my conferences, after the conference is over and I've done the Q&A session, I give presents out to people. Sometimes I raffle things, but often I give them away and people come up and they want to give me money. And I say, no, it's a present. And they're so conditioned that they can't understand why I would give them something and not want anything back. But this is the system that we need to understand, that unconditional love means that you can give something without expecting something in return. You make a very, very good point. People would say, well, how do I buy something? How do I get something? And I'm going to give you a little scenario. You talked earlier about cats, so let's talk about cats. I've got a cat. My cat's sick. Let's hope he never gets sick. But let's say he gets a bit unwell. I go to the vet, and the vet treats him, gives me some drugs for him. I don't pay the vet, right? I put my cat in the basket, I come home. The vet works Monday to Friday, sees all these patients, doesn't get paid. The vet goes on a Friday to the supermarket because he's got a wife and kids and needs to feed. So he gets the trolley, puts everything in it, goes up to the woman on the cash till she presses the buttons, puts it all in. There's another member of staff who helps to bag it up. He doesn't pay for it. The cashier, her job isn't to take money, but is to calculate what's going on from the shop and what needs to be ordered. That's her job. Let's talk about somebody who hasn't got any skills and never went to college, but maybe they care for a sick person. That's their job. Now, I relayed this, and somebody, just to show the mindset, said, yes, but who would pay the people to fly the food in from another country? Because the conditioning is so strong that it wouldn't work at the moment simply because of this. Somebody, I don't want to say a farmer, but somebody who's in a position of power and responsibility would say, hang on a minute, I'm more important than the man that takes the trash out. I should have 3 televisions. I should have 2 loaves of bread. I should have 2 foreign holidays a year. So human consciousness is not yet at that position where people can let go of that ego. But when that happens, then people will say, I should be able to live in a house and not pay for it. I should be able to keep warm, drink water, and eat food and not have to pay for it. Sure, if I want a really up-to-date, big, big, big flat-screen television, I've got to pay for that. But the basics of life should be free. Now, your viewers and listeners won't know that in the 1970s, we had a Labour government which actually set a price for bread, butter, eggs, bacon. It actually said that no shopkeeper could charge more than a set price. And this was attacked as communism, the end of the Western world, the death of capitalism. All the government did was say basic foods should only be at a set price. And unfortunately, that prime minister, a very, very honourable man called Harold Wilson, there was a conspiracy by the army almost to remove him militarily, a coup in Great Britain. Can you imagine it? He resigned. He resigned rather than be got out by the army. Simply because he was a sea operator. But of course, that would be reported in many countries. So we have a situation, I think, where whether it's food, whether it's money, people have to make a decision what's important. You know, I've seen guys who have their own yacht, have the most expensive cars, and then their girlfriend gets cancer. And suddenly, all the values they have in the world just change. The things that really matter to them don't. What matters to them is that their loved one gets well. And so they look at their yacht that costs £3 million or $3 million, and they look at their expensive car and they say, does it matter? Because my wife, the woman I love, who's given birth to my children, is dying of cancer. So it's amazing when people are faced with a shock, they reevaluate their life and they decide what's really important to them. Now, I don't want people to have those sort of shocks. I don't want that to happen, but I do want people to look at the way they're living their life and say, is it right? Is it fair? Is it equitable? Am I really happy? And, you know, these are the questions that each individual on this planet must do. And it is in America where this decision will be made. America is the country. That's why you had the founding fathers. And that's why you had your constitution, your Bill of Rights, because it is the one country in the world that can actually make change for good. So it is over to you guys. You are going to lead the way and others will follow you.
I want to just go back to the earlier question. In terms of multidimensional or extraterrestrial races that are working to, or that are interested in the growth of consciousness and the Earth consciousness moving in a positive direction, what are some of those races that you're personally familiar with or might have interacted with?
There's quite a number of them. In America, you have a guy called Alex Collier. He's down on his luck at the moment. He's a genuine person. And I have a lot of support for him. A radio show for a British radio station coming up this week. I think it's British, Scottish, I think, possibly. So I would say to listeners, please listen on the internet to that because he's a genuine guy. He's in connection with fifth or sixth dimensional entities. Many of these entities that are benevolent to humanity come from the following groups. Palladian, Andromedian, Arcturus. There are some of the what we would call Nordic races. And there are a couple of other very exotic type races as well. So there's more than one group. Often people talk about the aliens as if it was just one great lump. It isn't. Just as on the planet Earth, someone from Japan has got a completely different take on life as somebody from England. And what I would say is that by and large, these groups have decided that they will be involved. They have been involved and they wish humanity to make a choice. They're not going to come and do all the work for the human race. What they're doing is leveling the playing field so that the truth becomes obvious to those who have eyes to see and ears to hear. And those who can see and hear the truth, they then will do something about it. Custer, the 7th Cavalry, is the human race, but to get us to that position, we've been nudged and helped. In my own country, I know we're running out of time now, but in my own country, facts have come out about illegal activities that have occurred, which have been hidden for over 50 years. Why are they coming out now? Because human consciousness is demanding it. And just this week, a past, he's dead now, British Prime Minister called Sir Edward Heath, the police are now investigating him for crimes against children. Now, that has been hidden for 30, 40 years. Why is it happening and coming out now? Because human consciousness is evolving faster than the elite can hide stuff. This is what I mean by the truth is coming out. And as the truth comes out, the picture builds for people and they begin to realize that they've been living in a bit of a sham.
Now, I've heard some talk about a new extraterrestrial race that's interacting called the avian race. Are you familiar with that?
I am. and to be very careful what I say here, the back end, as we say in Great Britain, the end of last year, the fall of last year, the Vatican telescope, the Vatican controls two telescopes. One is an infrared telescope, which they call the Lucifer telescope. And I always think that's really amazing that a Catholic church would call its own telescope Lucifer. That's why I don't like religion, really. So you've got two telescopes. The Lucifer telescope infrared detected an alien spacecraft, huge, entering Earth's solar system. They thought that it was their friends coming back. They found that it wasn't. Then we had stories about blue avians. I did a radio show with another guy called Andy Kramer, who was a reserve captain in the Marines in America. And the radio show was a guy called Alfred Weber. I found Andy Kramer to be very credible, and he himself said that some of the memories he had in his head might have been implanted. So he was aware of that. And I always know someone's genuine when they can admit to the fact that some of the memories might not be true. The person who I'm not going to name was very, very prevalent about these blue avians. And he actually said that he totally agreed with Randy Kramer and could back up everything he said. What I would say is that if you have a false memory implanted in you, you will always back up another false implanted memory in somebody else. And I know because very clear understanding of how people are given false memories. I, for heaven's sake, I worked just to help somebody who is employed by the Rothschilds. So I understand about mind control. So, what I would refer to as multi-personality syndrome, suicide programs. When individuals have been interacted in that way, then many of the memories that they have, they genuinely believe are their own. And they would pass a lie detector test because there's no chemical imbalance when they're telling a lie, because to them it's the truth. So one has to be incredibly careful and sensitive when dealing with such people. Blue avians, yeah, I've got no knowledge of them. Can't help you with it.
I see. So it sounds like you see overall an awakening of consciousness and we're heading in a positive direction, although we may have some difficulties in the next couple of years to overcome before we head in that direction. Is that about sum it up?
Yes. I don't doubt the human race is going to make it, but I don't know what condition we're going to be in. Are we going to walk proudly through the door, or are we going to crawl through on our knees? That's the only section that is open for the debate at the moment. Mm-hmm.
So tell me a little bit about your work. Now, you work with individuals to help. You mentioned it briefly, and you also have a website and newsletter. Where can people find out about what you're doing and maybe even contact you if they're interested in working with you?
Yes, that's absolutely fine. I'm very, very pleased that a doctor, a scientific doctor, has asked for, and I've given him space on my website. You know, I wish to draw professional people who know the truth and know that they will get protection under my umbrella. So this is what we want to do, trying to build a group of people, a wide-ranging discipline. So yes, the website's simonparkes.org, and I work with clients where obviously anonymity and confidentiality is very important, where they can come to me when they have issues. I do what I call my bread and butter readings. I can read somebody's soul, give them some help and support, and I charge a very small amount for that. None of these huge expensive costs. One person said to me, "Oh, you can't be very good because you're so cheap." And I reply, "I'm cheap because I want everyone to access, not just the wealthy." But I do have clients who have come from very unusual backgrounds and have a range of issues, whether it's mind control, whatever, you know, that may be, and I will do deprogramming. The instance, I don't give the person's name because I obviously have to be very careful, but a person came to me some 3 years ago, and I believed at the time they'd come to me of their own self. I now know that the Rothschilds had funded this, and the reason they didn't tell me was they were worried that I would turn around and say, "I'm not going to help you." it shows they didn't know me very well, because if ever a person is hurt as a child and then grows up and has those issues, I will always help that person, because I don't care who they are, what they are. If they need help, I'll help them. And in this person's case, they had six separate personalities. They had a suicide program, which had been put into their mind, and a number of other issues. It did take me 6 months, but ultimately that person now is working, holds down a job. When this person came to me, she had an IQ, if she's listening, I hope I get it right, she had an IQ of 162, which I believe is genius level. She left at 184. That's why she works where she works. So it soon became apparent to me that I have the ability to work with people in a way that very few others, A, are able to, and B, are prepared to. Because if you start doing what I'm doing in the public domain, there's always somebody high up who doesn't like it. But I do it, and that's what my job, and I enjoy doing it.
So you're able to somehow raise the intellectual capacity of our individual, or is it that she had all these multiple personalities and just simply removing them raise her IQ?
Right. You don't remove them. That would be death. You can't do that. No individual personality would agree to being removed like that, because they would see that as death. When a person creates a sub-personality, it has a life of its own. No, you have to go for reabsorption. That personality has to agree to go back and join the core. Then you have one person, but with different flavors. That's the best way to describe it. And once you rejoin the fractured person, their IQ naturally builds. In her case, you see, she was tortured as a child. And what they do is they put electrodes on your head, pass an electric shock through it, and it creates a crease that runs across the cortex of the brain. Now, that initially is dead, but because it's a child, it's always growing. The growth rate is much faster. The crease increases the surface area of the cortex. Then the neurons grow through the dead material. And over a period of time, if you electrocute the person enough times, you are increasing the cortex by 15 to 20%. So that is where all the higher thoughts are occurring. Hence, you increase the intellectual capacity. The problem is, if you don't do it right, from their perspective, you create brain damage. And I'm not going to go into the story, but there was a reason why I had to help this particular individual. But there is always a reason. They don't just torture people for torture's sake. There is a ultimate reason for it. It's about awesome in a certain state of mind that is beneficial to the organization. It's evil. It's wrong. And if I am presented with a person who has issues like that, I will help them. If they can afford to pay me, they pay me. If they can't afford to pay me, I do it for nothing. You know, I do it for nothing, because how can I turn away somebody who has been tortured? I can't. So I'm very lucky. I have some donors. They don't give me much. $10 here, $5 here. Some people give me more. And those contributions that they pay keep me and my small team of volunteers going, because there's just a handful of us. And it allows me to travel to see people, because I need to put gas in the car. And if the person can't afford to pay me, then I have a donor who's given me a few bucks or pounds, as it's in my country. So people can help in any way. Donating money is one way, but another way is sharing information. I'll make time for everyone. The problem is I'm only one person on his own with a small team of volunteers, and we get so many emails, we can't cope with them all. So I do need more help. So if there's anybody out there who is of a good heart and has a few spare hours a week, give me a shout.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to speak with me today, Simon. It's been a pleasure, and learned a lot about your work and what's going on in the world. And hopefully we can have you back on the show again sometime in the future.
Well, I'd be delighted to. So thank you very much indeed. It's very kind and gracious of you to invite me to the show. And I hope your viewers and listeners have enjoyed it and they do their own research. So God bless.
Thank you. Well, that's it for our show today. Join me next week for another incredible show on Awaken and Power TV, where we explore the individuals who are out there on the leading edge and changing the world.